Just step back home. We've been discussing this with various people. We will not finish by quarter to 12, quite clearly. Can we have... we have to ask the questions, to be fair to the Public Protector's Office. Otherwise, we have to recall you, which is very wasteful of your time and expenditure. So, I've been consulting. Some members have parliamentary duties they have to go to, which will allow them to do that. They're very important functions. We will reconvene at 2:30. There will be some food here, about 2:15 or so, perhaps. Yeah. We'll reconvene at 2:30.
We have a disciplinary...
I know. We'll let you off. We'll be keeping full records of these proceedings, Mr. Funnell. The alternative is to recall them. And our timetable, as you know, the schedule we gave you before Christmas, is so full. Oh, they say you have a dinner. Oh, the disciplinary committee meets here. Let's see then. Let's have sharp, precise questions. Then we'll determine according to whether we recall you then. Okay? Yeah. So we now, it's a relief to the chairperson who's been burning the candle at both ends for the last few months. So it's a relief. Now, we're dealing with Parliament and relationship. Can we have sharp questions and precise answers then? Now, Mr. Johnson is taking us through first. The general issues then.
Before going on to Parliament, can I just touch on the last page of question one where they list their four constraints? You've listed four constraints. It's budget, retention of staff, cooperation by organs of state, and the media. But if you look at your budget specifically, you're getting, in fact, more money, significantly more money. 55 million in 2006, 67 million in 2007, 74 million in 2008. So could you discuss the budgetary constraints as well as touch on the three other that you've raised? I'm on page 21 of the document.
Whether our accounting CFO will answer the real figures. I'll just give the broad outline why we see it as a problem. Since I came into the office and my reading of the past, for instance, we have never been able to fill up all our posts. As I'm speaking right now, we are not able to fill all our posts. There are still posts that are vacant because we don't have money. And when we submit our organogram, we do indicate that each time when we go to a strategic planning, our strategic plan will tell us what we are supposed to be doing. And in the light of the strategic plan, then we are able to draw an organogram to support the strategic plan. So, but when you don't have money, then you appoint a limited number of people. And part of the problem, for instance, you see, we got an approval long ago to appoint a CEO. We didn't have money. We have not appointed that person until of to date. So that is the background from which we come from.
Because you only appoint the chief financial officer following the inquiry last August. But I see it's actually chief financial officer. Yeah. We don't have a chief executive officer yet. Right? Which is, now, you presumably you have a transformation plan, because I want to refer to this. Transformation plan. But you mentioned on page 28 the employment equity program brings you positive results, but the employment equity plan is part of the transformation plan, isn't it? But I see that there are no colours, for example. No colours males, no coloured females. I thought if you look at representativity, you should look at representativity across the board. And there's regional representativity, national representativity. In Western Cape, colours form 54% of the population. So I'm not looking at arithmetical positions. If you have difficulties in filling posts, then it's very difficult to understand why, in fact, senior posts such as chief executive officer have not been filled, when there are people from other population groups who could have been available. So do you have a transformation plan in the context of the employment equity legislation? Secondly, I don't see, when I look at the composition of your senior staff and your middle-level staff and your general staff, because figures you've provided, that they in fact are truly representative of South Africa. In fact, a disproportionate representation, rather than representativity. So could you answer that question, Johnson's question, at the same time allude to this as to why you have difficulty when in fact there are no colours working at all in your management level, and put down.
Thank you, Chair. On the question, for instance, of the chief executive officer having to be appointed when we don't have other people, it depends on the ranks. Because we may have a rank of an investigation officer, and we advertise the post. And the reality, what happens, if you look at it, you look at Western Cape, because the majority happens to be colored, we do have colors. There are areas where they are predominantly blacks, and you can send an advert 20 times. I remember in the Free State, for instance, I don't know how many times we cancelled advert because we did not find, for instance, an Afrikaans-speaking person from that area. So those are the realities of the fact. While we want to comply, the practicality of the thing is that it hasn't happened in practice.
There's obviously a tension between delivery and representativity. There has to be a tension. All the committee is asking is, how do you give priority if you have to perform some function that Parliament and the Constitution confer on you, when posts are not filled, and the money is available, by the way. Quite clear the money is available. How do you resolve this tension? All of us have to do that. How do you resolve this tension?
No, I think what talking past is that posts that are not filled, of course, that where we don't have money. It is not that we don't fill posts because we can't find a particular color. What we are doing, for instance, when I give an example of Free State, is that there was that need for a temporary time and the person could not find the person. The post that we are not filling is because we don't have money to fill them.
Sorry. It's insulting. The point is that one of the submissions we received from the Treasury is that institutions such as regional offices, provincial offices, without taking into account the long-term funding of those offices. All that I'm saying here, as chair of this committee, is that a central role, chief financial officer, was only filled after the intervention of Parliament. The chief executive officer, it's inconceivable that a body with such enormous powers and administrative demands does not have a chief executive officer. That's what the committee is asking. But this affects your efficiency. We're not talking about each other. The priority should have been to have a chief executive officer, taking into account the balancing between representativity and efficiency. Now, you have to return to that. Maybe it's something the committee will look at, right? But maybe you might like to respond. I'm not telling us that we're talking past each other. Do not talk past each other.
Yeah. For our office, it is not true that regional offices are formed without taking into account financial constraints. We have a standing agreement with Treasury, where Treasury has said every year it will allocate money for the establishment of two regional offices. So that is a standing relationship, and therefore any regional office that is formed by us, it is in terms of what Treasury has said to us, and we are speaking to that. So it's not true of us. And then when it comes to the question of the CFO, it is not wholly true that the chief financial officer was appointed because of an instruction from Parliament, because it was already advertised. The post of chief financial officer only became vacant when somebody resigned, and it was just a month and the advert was already out for the appointment of chief financial officer. And then for the IT officer, if you look at the list that we have supplied, it was only because the IT had resigned, and we have interviewed the IT, is starting, we have finalized the interview now. When it comes to the chief chief executive officer, it was precisely that we did not have enough funds that we could not appoint that individual. We have advertised the post now, and when we talk financial constraints, that post I think was approved at level 14. We advertised, we could not find appropriate candidates, and that's when we wrote to Treasury to ask that the post be upgraded, and Treasury has come back to us now to say, look, we don't approve your request. Number one, justice has said to us that you can't appoint a chief financial, chief accountant, a CEO. Firstly, because you must appoint a CEO, because in terms of the public service regulation, which is very strange to us. Number two, it says we are not approving because you must first amend the Public Protectors Act, which we found to be very strange, and we have got a letter to that effect. And that's yet another thing that
holds one thing for the committee, which is, now obviously, the prima facie could affect the independence of the body. So there's a degree of administrative control of appointments by the Department of Justice or the Treasury. It seems to me, that's not a conclusion. We'll take your letter from you, please, if it says so, that you must only appoint a certain level. Obviously, there has to be financial supervision, but the degree of supervision here seems to interfere with the independence of the body. Thank you very much. Ms. Johnson?
On the issue of staff retention and your problems with the media that you alluded to.
Staff retention, I think what we are doing presently, we are, with the recommendation of the ad hoc committee, we are formulating a policy on staff retention. At the time when we came to the committee, we already had a service provider who had already formulated a remuneration policy for us. We are busy with job evaluation, which is towards the end, because staff retention has to do also with job evaluation. So that is a process that's ongoing in terms of that. When we say media, it's not as if media, we expect media not to be critical of us. We really want to be criticized where we are going wrong, obviously. But sometimes, you know, we want to be criticized in the manner that we will be able to pick up something to be able to move forward. And if, for instance, you just find a statement saying, look, you found in favor of the ruling party. And I ask myself, where will I find against a person who's not from the ruling party, because it's not in any department. There's never been any complaint. In other words, there are instances where the criticism are not genuine. And for instance, I was looking at a report where they only took the negatives. And then I have reports, but I do not want to take that into account. But you must understand that we don't say the media must not criticize. They must go on. As long as it's constructive, we'll welcome that.
And that's why it's Ms. Thank you.
Chairperson, through you, to the public protector. Let me say that I was not only surprised but disappointed to find you listing under constraints not only the media before the state, but also opposition parties. And you have just really repeated what you alleged there, that your difficulty with the media is, in essence, you're saying that they are sensationalist And that they like to cover controversial and, I quote, highly politicized matters. And you reiterate by notice. And on the subject of opposition parties, you say, in order to gain some public exposure, we tend to file complaints and then react to findings and decisions. And I express disappointment because we are advocates, all part of a great system which must make our democracy work. The Fourth Estate is an indispensable part of that system. Not only opposition parties, but members of parliament all have a duty to exercise oversight and to see the principle is upheld. And it seems to me a most unfortunate approach to take, to accuse either the Fourth Estate or now in particular opposition parties of seeking publicity and sensation, when in fact we are addressing the abuse of power. You are uniquely put in a position to address the abuse of power on behalf of all of us, all of our citizens. And you see, and that read together with your commencement statements on cooperative governance is very disturbing. Now, I'd like your comment, but regrettably you've already nodded that you still maintain that.
No, please. It's imprudent, injudicious to have made those statements in your report to Parliament. It is really unnecessary and unfortunate. And I think that expressing the views of the committee, but it should not have been made. This is supposed to be a response to questions of mine. Obstacles are not, the press are not obstacles. How much I may disagree with the opposition, they're not obstacles. They're part of a democratic flowering in our country. And that is why now you have a senior press person I see appointed now. And it's his job, or your job, to ensure that if there are unfortunate or malicious or wrong, full responses to your position, then you have a right to reply to them. So, can I say therefore, but we can't have a response on this when the committee believes that, in fact, it should not have been made in the first instance. Thank you. Now, so come to the end of this question, please.
Chair, through you, I really would want to give the reason why I said that.
I don't think you made your case already. It's there in front of us. You've had a committee response that it's regrettable that there should be a position taken that time.
So I just say I've got facts to substantiate what I've said.
No.
I want to say it if you want.
No. Please, I think we're having an unnecessary departure from the proceedings we've had so far. That in fact, you made the statement there, the justification of that would be for another occasion. A member of the committee, two members of the committee, have raised queries about that, how there should be an obstacle. Ms. Nutt's point was, it's not an obstacle to your work. It's not a detriment arising. It's very much part of the normal democratic realm. Now, my job as chairman is to uphold the dignity of the Chapter 9 bodies. Right? We are enjoined to do that. I don't think we are upholding the dignity of Chapter 9 bodies if there's a response to the debate on this, frankly. So, Ms. Johnson.
Thank you. Moving on to the relationship between the Public Protector and Parliament. On page 29 of your response, you say that your liaison with the Justice Portfolio Committee is, quote-unquote, according to you, insufficient. And then you propose that a special parliamentary committee be set up dealing with Chapter 9s only. My question to you is, what would a special Chapter 9 Portfolio Committee do differently than what the Justice Committee can do for you in any event? And is it not, as part of your cooperative governance arrangement, your responsibility to approach the Justice Committee when there are issues that you want to bring to Parliament's attention? And do you really think that a special Chapter 9 body will be able to assist you more?
Thank you, Chair. That is our opinion. And what you are suggesting can be another way of looking at it. Because our experience was that sometimes we'll come to Parliament and you find that in the committee there are only 2-3 members, and it happens once a year. And we are saying that we would want to interact more with Parliament, because there is a lot that Parliament can offer, like the proposal you are making. We are just saying, look, can there be another mechanism where we'll interact more and get issues like this raised in where we can debate issues like that, you know, on a regular basis. That is the approach we...
You mean honorable speech?
Yeah.
Thank you. No, that is very valuable. We will hear the portfolio committee also when we get submission from them. That's been the general trend, advocate. Unhappiness in Parliament. Now, can I make a suggestion? If you want to respond to the queries raised by Ms. Johnson and Ms. Smuts, you can write to me, right? And give me chapter and verse, and I'll take it up with the committee. I think it would be an appropriate thing, so not to silence you, to say, is this not a proper forum? But if you want to write, I would encourage you to write to me, and give me chapter and verse, according to the two paragraphs you have, and then I will consider whether it's appropriate for the committee. So, we have come to the conclusion that, in fact, you would like some more systematic relationship with Parliament. Right? Ms. Johnson?
Thanks, Chair. On page 30, you argue that your office has indirect oversight function over the other Chapter 9 institutions. Now, reading Section 181(2) of the Constitution, which says that the other Chapter 9s are independent and subject only to the Constitution and the law, how do you come to that conclusion?
Maybe it may not be explicitly stated. I'll give a practical example, for instance. My understanding in that statement was not that you will go and investigate the human rights per se. For instance, we have had a complaint against the Human Rights Commission, a delayed action, where somebody said, I submitted a complaint to the Human Rights Commission. This has not been dealt with. We also had a delay against the Gender Commission, specifically we conducted an investigation on that particular issue, not on the institutional body, but on the grievance that has been lodged by staff members. That is intended to refer to specific that, but not that I can review a decision of gender or human rights, no, but specific complaint. Maybe I can benefit from your view on that, because it's an issue that will keep on coming.
I want to thank the recommendation of the
public protector that he recommends an special parliamentary oversight committee for all Chapter 9 institutions. Would he agree that more than one such oversight committee would be more ideal to ensure that oversight role is performed with absolute diligence?
Thank you very much.
Comment on that.
Very precise.
Yes, when we made that recommendation, for instance, we, in our view, was to say, look, if that committee was to look only at the public protector, we're not sure whether that would be enough for that particular committee. But if indeed we can have an oversight committee, actually the practice has been, according to our observation, if you were to look at, for instance, this language, they've got their specific committees, only us, the three of us, that goes to the Justice Committee. Other committees, other Chapter 9, Chapter 10, they go to the public service, for instance. There is already there. But if, like you say, you will interview them, I mean, if they can be capacitated and increase the number of how they can interact with us, I think your view can work, because we already have similar parliamentary or portfolio committees. So if the interaction can be increased, maybe you may not even need one specialized committee.
Yes, actually a follow-up on this one. In answering, have you considered the delineation between the substantive issues arising out of your work, for example, your report that you published about findings on the one hand, and your operational kind of area of work. In other words, the normal reporting relationship that exists between Parliament and public bodies. And as a follow-up to that, having considered that distinction, do you still feel that both matters should go to the same committee, that is, if a separate committee was created, or would you see a situation where, depending on the nature of the report, you may find yourself having to report to another, you know, committee that Parliament may determine?
Yes, my thinking is that, for instance, the substantive, when it comes to, for instance, if I write a report on mineral and energy, I would expect the Committee on Mineral and Energy, which specializes on that particular one, if they want some clarity, for me to appear before that committee would be more appropriate. So I would say on the substantive matters, it would be good if Parliament was to interact with us on the substantive matters in order to assist us, because the people there, when we make a recommendation, we want it to be implemented. And the purpose of interaction would be to ask the committee to assist us in terms of making sure that our recommendations are implemented.
It's the first time we have a recommendation like that. What they're saying, in other words, proactively, when you make a recommendation, you would like, in fact, it was a very important one, serious one, a particular portfolio committee to address it. For that, you'd need a postbox in Parliament, wouldn't you? You need a postbox. In other words, you need to be able to say to some structure in Parliament, this is our report, could you arrange for us with the portfolio committee and local government, or provincial affairs, or portfolio? You need a postbox for that, isn't there? At present, there is not a postbox. That's a very original recommendation, which we'll note, but it may be addressed not to the portfolio committee as line function matters. Can we complete this matter by saying that, look at the budget process. Now, the budget process, you say, is fair, but you quote other countries that maybe what happens, you know, when there's a different president or different minister, you know. You're therefore saying, because we ask this question of every board commission comes for us, what are you recommending? Now, tell us first the process with the committee. What exactly happens from April onwards about your budgets? And then your recommendation.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, can I just understand the question properly? Do you want to know about the budgeting process, how we actually work out what funding we require?
No, no, you've got
that
what you want.
Okay.
It was
35
million more.
Uh-huh. Yeah. 50 million more. It's gone up 100%, by the way, in the last 8 years. So you want that money. So how do you process it? After you've gone through all the committees in the public office, public project, how do you process it?
See, I think that's an interesting one, and I'm glad you've brought it up. I think, well, while I'm answering this, I just want to, you know, react to something that you said about the post boxes and issuing 2 million pamphlets. Here. So what happens is we redraw a budgeting cycle on a 3-year cycle, and that's approved by Parliament. But before each financial year, we review that process to see if we have other funding initiatives or other projects that coming through that we need to fund. Based on that, we prepare a resubmission or a new submission to Parliament. In this new financial year, where we received the 74 million for the 2007-08 financial year, our unfunded priorities, our additional requirements amounted to approximately 22 million. So that was submitted through to Justice. Justice in turn submitted to National Treasury.
You said it's Justice. Is there an interaction with Justice? Well, that's what I want to know. I mean, whom do you meet as Chief Financial Officer and your delegation? Whom do you meet? I know what happens in government departments.
Yeah.
So whom do you meet in Justice?
So within justice, we are program. We consolidated all the Chapter 9 institutions into a program. Justice has allocated budget coaches to address each of these programs. So we meet with our budget coach, who in turn collects our submission, along with all the other Chapter 9s, and then make a submission to his chief director of budgeting, who in turn goes to the CFO, and that in turn goes to National Treasury.
Is there an opportunity to defend? You can make proposals for 4 increases, isn't there? 4 programs, right? Now, my departments have a right to go defend those claims, right? At Treasury. Now, here, the postman is not the postman. It's just as somebody in the system decides, right, whether to accept your budget proposal, is it? That's what I want to know. But there's no interaction.
It's good to talk about that because I'm not financially acute. But in practice, for instance, you will have, as Chapter 9, somebody in Treasury who is appointed to say, look, this is a pattern in Treasury, will be dealing with you.
Or does justice scrutinize nothing, and does it fall within, for example, their own Chapter 9 increases budget? First of all, what does the Department of Justice do to your application?
Justice is our spokesperson at the budget committee. We don't have a right to motivate our budget. To defend it, or we can't go beyond that.
So you don't get your day in court with the Justice Department. That's what I want to know. So they could then decide in their own discretion as to whether your application for 25 million more is inappropriate. It should be 15 million. They can decide that.
No, sir. I think what happens is we submit our information to the Department of Justice, who in terms of the National Treasury. If there's any questions on what we need funding for, we don't have that interaction with National Treasury. The Department of Justice will do that on our behalf. So we don't meet directly with the people who set our budget.
And the fact that the apostolic succession rests in the Department of Justice, and it's rests there, they will then be your defenders.
And that's why I raised initially our unfunded priorities of 22 million. We received a letter back from National Treasury indicating that we've been allocated 4 million. 22. Our unfunded priorities of 22, we received an additional allocation. Priorities are the additional funds that we require in the new financial year. So the new initial projects that we've decided we need to fund, we make a submission for that. And we don't have a representation our executives do not have an opportunity to present why we need that 22 million. So we almost come back.
No. What happens now? Parliament passes the corruption bill. Enormously important. Very wide. Who looks after the funding of that when complaints come to you? Is it additional? Is it a funded mandate or unfunded mandate?
So that's part of our 22 million, and answering the question, let me say this. Part of the 22 million, we included an additional allocation of 8 million rand for accommodation. Previously, it was a responsibility for the department.
My question about the corruption legislation, or the freedom of information legislation.
So
there will be increasing demands made. There has to be a specialist in freedom of information legislation. Is it a funded mandate or unfunded mandate?
So we'd have to reprioritize our funds. So we'd have to, based on our scaling of projects, reprioritize it and unfund some of the projects that we initially thought we funded to fund that. So we request funding.
What kind of question is to go to the Special Portfolio Committee? But the Chapter 9 body is getting a mandate which is not funded. Right? That's what I meant earlier when I talked about the application of the Freedom of Information legislation, right? How do we expect you to work out the structure? I think you need a senior person to deal with complaints about freedom of information, especially this kind of thing. So, that's quite clear. the conduit, justice is the conduit, it goes directly to the treasury, and the treasury deals with that in a kind of sacramental way, you know, the confessional box. They listen to you, what you write, and then they decide.
The point is, they can't defend it. They can't defend it. That is the problem.
We've discussed that because there are hundreds of these programs. Hundreds of these programs. The point is that each department has a right to defend it to the budget committee, the ministers, and before that, the civil servants go and discuss it. In fact, the budget committee now is the member staff. So you don't have that opportunity of interacting. Okay, thank you.
I have a little postscript question, and then let me just mention that my colleague Sheila Camara has just sent me a note to say that the Justice Department itself has unfunded mandates to the tune of $2 billion. So you see the problem. Here's a little postscript question, because you've been setting out the important, the conduit question. A little earlier, Advocate Mushwana referred, I'm quite sure, to letters written to Treasury. You seem to have then at a later stage of the budgeting process, do you write directly? Now, is there, in that case, any intermediary function by Justice, or are you free to approach and to be granted or denied?
That's where I was trying to illustrate when I said there is somebody in Treasury who's appointed to look at our budget. You see, we had already submitted our MTEF. Then there was this injunction from the parliamentary committee that we needed to appoint a CEO. And because we're coming from where we could not find suitable candidates, we had to ask for additional funding because we had already submitted that. So we wrote a letter to this person who is in Treasury to say, look, we have this position, we need to advertise this post at a particular level, but we had already submitted our MTEF. In other words, this person also serves as a person who interacts with us as to what is possible, what is not possible financially, as Chapter 9, and what is located in the Treasury. So that's how it came about that we wrote that letter to this individual, and seemingly that individual then submitted that our request to Justice. I mean, that's how we read the contents of the letter, and that's how Justice
came. Thank you. We will end at quarter two. Providing, in fact, we have the following subjects to deal with as part of some reference. They carry on of one complaint to the next year, a delay in dealing with that. I refer you to their annual report. So Ms. Johnson will deal with that, right? Okay. Then we deal with the internal arrangements, the organization, or internally, right? We will deal with that. And then we deal with, finally, question of ethics within a disclosure of interest. So there are three important topics left, if I can identify them. We should finish them by quarter two. So can we deal very quickly with Parliament? It's quite clear you would like more systematic oversight of Parliament, more deeper interaction with Parliament. You made your proposal yourself, which I think is a very important one. You can might go to a specific portfolio committee, not only the Justice Committee. Okay. And then overall, the question of Parliament's own role is to get Parliament's act right. So that's our job to do that. Now, can we deal very quickly with this question? Now, evaluation, success, very important of your work. You say on 7.2, the success rate in this regard is very high. But we don't have any further information. One, how do you arrive at that? And then secondly, what is the evidence for the success rate very high? Because success rate means that you made a recommendation, you made remedial proposals, the department or the other parastatal or whatever body has accepted it. Also, you supervise the implementation of the recommendation. So how do you arrive the success rate very high?
Thank you, Chair. This is actually a new strategic objective which was not there until our 2005 2004-2005, if I remember correctly. In other words, what we are talking about here is where we have made recommendation and check whether this recommendation has been implemented. And what we are doing, like I indicated earlier on, is that where a recommendation has been made on a quarterly basis, we do report what is happening to the recommendation. What we did not make clear there is that there are other methods, process where in writing one letter or on a telephone, you are able to settle that matter. And whether one can include that on the success rate. Because if you look at this, say 17,000 cases completed, not in all of those cases where we have written a report. What we are doing is that in cases where we don't make a recommendation, we write a closing report because it doesn't go anywhere. But there are areas where we have written specific reports. So in terms of evaluating, we do have, I've collated a few information of the reports that we have issued, where we have made follow-up, and I do have the documentation, which I can...
We'll receive that. The point is that you presume you have a database, say, but for the financial year 2008-09, you hope to have 90% recommendation. Well, it says implemented, but accepted, I think it means. We use the word implemented. You have a database for that, then. So you can supply us for whatever figures are available for the recommendations. Now these are specific examples. But what we want is out of the 16,000-17,000 cases you have, how many you've decided that the provinces are, and the database to say that just a clinical thing, not an assessment, but so many have been successfully implemented. You can give us a database.
Yes, we will share, and I don't know whether you will want those cases where, for instance, the Honorable Fandamerbe doesn't want to pay me
the
department,
no.
And we fight.
You give us already the cases, half a dozen Western Cape, Free State, and all. Right? And what we want is the statistics, which, in your opinion, satisfactory conclusion. Just substantiate. The 7.2 success rate is very high. Just to substantiate that. And you're aiming for 90%, which is remarkable. How do you hope to get that on the basis of this year's success rate? Now, the next question, very important, if I can quote, is the central issue of the relationship between the center, that's Pretoria, and your provinces. And I see you're a provincial coordinator. The question here is, if a complaint comes in from Ingwa Vuma in KwaZulu-Natal, who decides whether it's sufficiently important to go to head office or to be dealt with in Durban or Pietermaritzburg? And then who has the second question behind the committee? Who carries out quality control as to, you know, what is happening in a particular case? Is that left entirely to the manager in the province, or the head office has some role in that? And then thirdly, the statistics you give us about successful completion, is that on the basis of the say-so of the provincial head, or is that an evaluation by head office?
Chair, our provincial offices are manned by senior managers. And for the purpose of answering this, I would say those are investigative units as well in their respective provinces. Where there are regional offices, the regional offices report to the province. At the national office, we also have got senior managers who look after certain investigation. If you are in Kwavuma, obviously your matter, if it relates to a provincial department, it will go to the province. That's where it will be dealt with. But however, there are instances where a complainant will say, no, I want this matter to be dealt with at the national office. We will give them the latitude, because normally we allow them, if it's easier for them to come to a particular province. We don't insist on saying, no, look, we can send you back. We don't send anybody back. But we make ourselves available to them in terms of our regional offices and the national offices. There are complaints against national departments. Normally, those ones who handle them at the national office. But even then, if the complaint, it is convenient for the complainant to go to our regional or our provincial office, we'll handle it from there. The control, the final control of what recommendation is to be made. When a report has to be made, it will first be submitted to the, our regional representative, who will analyze whether the report is fine and fair according to him. And then he will then submit that report to the provincial coordinator, who is located at the national office, who will place that matter on the role of the think tank. The think tank is, in simple language, I will call it the full bench. In other words, consists of the various senior managers in the different provinces and the national one, where we sit and analyze every report that comes from our office, because we wanted to make sure that I don't sit alone in my little corner and authorize the report, but then it's subjected to a debate until we make a final recommendation.
This would be about 15,000 a year.
I've indicated that it is not in every case. It is where we make a recommendation to Parliament or to a particular department. That's what we interrogate. But where a matter is settled, for instance, through negotiation, we don't go through the process. That's why you see the cases that we've given you are fewer, because those are special reports that we send to Parliament, to departments, to different institutions. Those are the cases where we interrogate them thoroughly, because then we are making a recommendation. So one assurance that your recommendation is implemented is that it must be based on facts, it must be factual, it must be correct in terms of the law. And that is the quality check that we carry out at the think tank.
Yeah, so when you make recommendations, there are three stages then. Three stages when they make a recommendation for record. There are three stages then. When you make a recommendation. Now, you'll be some of them don't come within your terms of reference at all. They may be, I've got lots of letters now about difficulties with laundries and about clothing. Lots of them. Laundries appear very large, by the way, in complaints. So you dismiss them before you. So you'll be a number of them. I presume 15-20% don't come within your jurisdiction. Isn't that so? About 15-20%. And then where, in fact, some could be dealt with very quickly. And then when you want to make a recommendation, there are three stages there, is there?
I think you are right in what you are saying. You know, part of why you might think that our statistics are going down. When we had to clean up what was happening, we had to consider that they used to lump what we call non-jurisdictional matters as factual. But now we have established a system in our various offices where at entry it is decided whether this is jurisdictional, non-jurisdictional. You will see in our future reports, we are going to have a column where we show the number of cases which came to us and we had to send them away because they are non-jurisdictional.
In future, you might say, cases rejected for jurisdictional reasons. Might be a good heading. Ms. Matsumola has been trying hard and then determined, and then we move on.
Thank you, Chair. Just a follow-up question. Is there a specific reason why you have many investigating officers, to be specific, 15, in the Northwest province as compared to the other provinces?
Well, what you need to know is that Northwest, for instance, even had an ombudsman even before we had the public protector's office. So, okay. So the other issue, the problem that we had, like I have indicated, that we had this job evaluation. There used to be a system whereby they will determine how many investigators you want. For instance, they will say if you complete about 15 cases per month and what have you, then you are entitled to so many investigators. And because of this, the inclusion of the non-jurisdictional matters, then you find that in some areas the appointments were inflated because they tended to include non-jurisdictional matters. And the 15 investigators in Northwest, one advantage with Northwest, it has got about four regional offices, one in Rustenburg, one in Freiburg, one in Kuruman. Oh, there are three, and it used to have Mabopane. So that's why it has got more investigators.
It's like pop radio television. So, not only 15 investigators, you have 18 support staff. Northern Cape has three support staff. Gauteng has two. Right? 18. Now, I allow you for both of the Swanas, which still live on, like a dull hand of history. It does seem that there must have been wasted, people dying, retiring. It does seem 18 is unfair to the other provinces.
Okay, thank you, Chair. I think Northwest, like the public protector has alluded, we've taken over the former Bukutazana Ombuds Line, and the structures were totally different to the way other offices are being operated. For instance, in other offices, all the other services, like your cleaning services, were being outsourced as part of the lease agreements. But in the Northwest, you still have got cleaners, you still have got groundsmen. And we couldn't just say we are retrenching those people. We had to carry them and then let them go through the process of normal attrition, which is the retirement. That is why we've got so many. Yeah, I mean, I think it was a situation of either we had to take that difficult decision to say you are not taking you along. And some of those people are almost closer to their retirement ages. But in terms of the idea.
No, this is a nice attitude. Okay. We're not micromanaging you. It's ever.
Just to piggyback on your question about complaint rate from a particular region of the country, I would like to know, of the complaints that you receive, let's say broadly within the context of the incident of corruption, how many of have you been able, for instance, to categorize them? Your 2001 country report on the anti-corruption efforts in South Africa distinguishes between types of corruption for purposes of this report, and it talks about criminal corruption. Those are cases that you would refer ordinarily to the NPA, corruption in the ethical sense, and corruption in the sense of the system not working, obviously the violation of the Bartholdi principles and the nine principles and values governing public administration. Have you been able to say, as far as the incidence of corruption, and guided by what your report of 2001 says, this is how corruption occurs, criminal corruption, etc., etc., and then go back to the public and make them aware that, yes, indeed, this is corruption when this occurs, etc.
Yeah, thank you. That is an important question. You will see, if you look at the report, that type of reporting ended in that year. You did not see it in the other reports. The reason there is that we had a system, you know, a computerized system, whereby we were able to record departments, different cases. So that system, as it got old, and then we were in the process of changing it, engaging CETA. CETA has until today not managed to correct that system because it involves, you need a case management system. We have paid CETA to improve that system. And then as they improved it, and when it had to be implemented, it had what they are in their language, they call it a time bomb. It never worked. And until today, as we speak, we are still fighting. The minister has been called in because we had paid for the system. So as we are now, we are grappling with our statistics because we have to do it manually. And at our strategic planning last year, we had people who came to advise us, and so that we started in a system to find an alternative way to deal with this, because as the case increases, who would want to be able, as we report about Western Cape, to say in Region F, corruption is higher in this line, in Region B, along that line. That has been the intention that we had, but we were held up by the lack of data. So we don't have that type of information because of this particular problem, which was in the process of addressing.
So, Chairperson, this would mean that the State Information Technology Agency itself is guilty of the last version of corruption in consciousness, etc.
Issue of internal governance is a term of reference, very important one, and this is in relation to the arrangements made inside the institution, and particularly grievance procedures function up. We have to ask specific questions. Can I start off on the basis that you do refer to in your documents something like the alleged problems that took place in the office. Well, this was a finding by Parliament that there were difficulties in the office. And it's regrettable to say alleged, because alleged is usually a throwaway line to say there was no proof about it. And I'm sure you'd like to reconsider the use of the word alleged. Yeah. It's very regrettable. You'll find it, please, because time's going on. You'll find it in due course, because it's a submission. Can we ask you, therefore, as to, for example, the whole question of institutional arrangements inside? Have you worked out the function, delegation of function, deputy, identification of jobs? Have you worked that out now satisfactorily?
Well, broadly, I will say, since that recommendations from the committee, for instance, as I indicated, the CFO has been appointed as the post was advertised. The HR manager has been appointed as it was the case then. And the IT manager, we finalized the interview for the senior IT manager and will be appointing. The CEO, we had to interview for a lower level. We have done the interviews. So what remains is the results from the vetting people. So those people, the appointments we were hoping would be made this week. So in terms of appointment for senior positions, I can say we are on course. Last year, on the 13th of November, we went for our stress plan to reprioritize or to look at who does what. We now have a stress plan for the 1st of April next year, which is out for printing. So we have highlighted who does what in terms of the stress plan.
You'll find that on paragraph 5.1, where you say you don't want to regurgitate the issues raised in the report. But of course, the Parliament was reviewing that report in March of this year. And so therefore we will have, presumably this committee will be given the arrangements made, particularly the actual functions to be performed by the deputy. Now, the last question from my part is the question of disclosure. We ask all bodies to do that. Now, it is true that people can seek remunerative activities outside without information of any kind. But you have a register of financial interests of the public protector, the deputy public protector, the senior managers, and those above the equivalent level of director in the government department. In other words, all their financial interests as civil servants have. And you have a register, and secondly, who is, I see if some person is available here. There doesn't seem to be a very senior person in charge of the register. And who is it accessible to, this register? Very important. Because we are going to make recommendations about outside interests of all members of the Commission. So, you have a register not only for remunerative employment outside, but a register of financial interests, houses,
houses, and shareholdings, partnerships that members of parliament would fill, for example. Gifts, very important. Is the register, and where is it vested, and who is it available to?
Yeah, Chair, and not to waste your time. All I want to say is, you know, there were not a single policy in that office until we started working on them in 2003. There were no policies, so we're working on every policy, which some of which we started implementing in 2004. So it was an enormous task. When it comes to finances, we found that there are little bits and pieces of documentation which are not coherent as I speak now. So we don't have a coherent financial disclosure because you ask for a document. So we are in the process, in our management meeting, we have tasked the team to draw formal documents on financial disclosure. But having said that, it is not as if we are just not doing anything about it. In the interim, all senior managers, they declare informally to me what they have, they disclose their interest to me. If they get a gift, or they first, even before they are given, they first check with us whether or not they can accept such a gift. No. And then,
you keep a register now.
For the disclosures, I have some of them. That's why I say it's very much informal up to this stage.
Now, well, we're not telling you what to do now. We just want the information that they can make their own recommendations. So you have an informal arrangement with senior managers.
Yes.
Not necessarily documented, but you're working out procedures and processes with a fairly senior person, possibly the deputy president, in charge of all the disclosures, which will be, because we will look at this issue and try to work out, who should be available to. At present, it's like the confessional box. It all stays inside. So, the confessional box should never be revealed, but we may have to make some recommendations. Any further questions from your side? Now, because there are people sitting around here which I should introduce to, but we don't have time. This is the research administrative support team led by Dr. Leon Gagel, who's head of research, and we have very senior people from the desks, legal advisors, researchers. They look very young, but actually very professional, really. And so very professional, and very much committed to the constitutional order. That's the important thing. Very much committed to the constitutional order. And I think it's very, very good that each time I should introduce you. Next time we have time, I'll introduce you by name. But thank you very much. Well, we've been through a long process.
I want to try out this
last one. Okay.
What we are doing with all our policies, and that's what will happen also with the financial disclosure, it is circulated to all our staff members once it's a draft document, with whatever it will contain. Then it goes back to the management meeting for adoption. So all I'm saying is that it will be difficult for me to say who will do what now, because all other policies here will go through the process.
They're standing forms already. Public Service Commission has them. Parliament has them. Right? So you don't have to get consultants to draft a policy for you. You might modify them. But the important thing is disclosure. And for us, what do you do with the information that's available? Particularly when you have investigative powers, where people's fortunes, destinies, lives in some cases, are involved. Right? And, we need to know their interests. So we haven't worked out exactly what we're going to do with the 11 bodies and the disclosure. But in the meantime, thank you very much. Thank the committee first, by the way. Secondly, you will supply us with some information. You know where to pass them on to. But in the meantime,
Thank you very much. We've had a long session, and you've been very agreeable in ensuring that we end in time to enable us to go to St. John's Cathedral. I declare this session closed. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.